I looked out of the mouth of the cave and across the deep gorge to the opposite hillside. No movement. I listened carefully but could hear nothing. We had walked in a northeasterly direction for about a mile, and as quickly as I could, I told Curtis what I had experienced in the other dimension, stressing my belief that Williams had been correct. We could stop this experiment if we could find the rest of the group and remember the larger vision. I could tell Curtis was resisting. He had listened for a while, but then began rambling about his past association with Charlene. I was frustrated that he knew nothing that might explain what she had to do with this experiment. He also told me how he had come to know David. They had become friends, he explained, after a chance meeting had revealed many common experiences in the military. I told him it was significant that he and I both had an association with David, and that we knew Charlene. I don't know what it means, he had said distractedly, and I dropped it. But I knew it was further proof that we had all come to this valley for a reason. Afterward, we had walked in silence as Curtis searched for the cave. When we had found it, he backtracked and erased our tracks with dead pine branches, and then had lingered outside until he was convinced we hadn't been seen. So, how do you think this group can build enough energy to have an effect on these people? He asked. I'm not sure exactly, I replied. We'll have to figure it out. He shook his head. I don't think anything like that is possible. Probably all I did with my little bit of explosives was to irritate them and put them more on guard. Maybe I should have taken out the door. No, I don't think so, I said. We're going to find the other way. How? It'll come to us. Suddenly, we heard the faint sound of the vehicles again, and simultaneously I noticed a movement on the down slope below us. Someone's out there, I said. We crouched down and looked closely. The figure moved again, partially obscured by the underbrush. That's Maya, I said, disbelieving. Curtis and I stared at each other for a long moment. Finally, I moved to get up. I'll go get her. He grabbed my arm. Stay low. And if the vehicles close in, leave her and come back here. Don't risk being seen. I nodded and ran carefully down the hill. When I was close enough, I stopped and listened. The trucks were still moving closer. I called out to her in a low voice. She froze for an instant, then recognized me and climbed up a rocky slope to where I stood. I can't believe I found you, she said, hugging my neck. I led the way back to the cave and helped her through the opening in the rock. She appeared exhausted and her arms were covered with scratches, some of them still bleeding. What happened? She asked. I heard an explosion and then those trucks were everywhere. Did anyone see you come this way? Curtis asked with irritation. He was up and looking outside. I don't think so, she said. I was able to hide. I quickly introduced them. Curtis nodded and said, I think I'll take a look. He slipped out through the opening and disappeared. I opened my pack and took out a first aid kit. Were you able to find your friend at the sheriff's office? No, I couldn't even get back to town. There were interior officials along all the path back. I saw a woman I knew and gave her a note to take to him. That's all I could do. I applied some antiseptic to a long gash across Maya's knee. So why didn't you leave with the woman you saw? Why did you change your mind and come back here? I don't know why I came back. Maybe because I kept having these memories. She looked up at me. I want to understand what's happening here. I sat down facing her and gave her a sketchy summary of everything that had happened since we parted, particularly the information Will and I had received about the group process of moving past the resentment to find the world vision. She looked overwhelmed, but seemed to accept her role. I noticed you weren't limping any longer. Yeah, I guess it cleared up when I remembered where it came from. She stared at me for a moment and then said, There are only three of us. You said Williams and Feynman had both seen seven. Where do you think they are? I don't know, I replied. I'm just glad you're here. You're the one who knows about faith and visualization. A few moments later, Curtis came back through the opening and told us he had seen nothing out of the ordinary. Curtis leaned back and handed her a canteen. You know, you took a hell of a risk walking around in the open like that. You could have led them right to us. Maya glanced at me, and then said defensively, "I was trying to get away. I didn't know you were up here. I wouldn't even have come this way if the birds hadn't caught my attention with the noise they were making." "Well, you've got to understand how much trouble we're in," Curtis interrupted. "We still haven't stopped this experiment." He got up and stepped outside again, and sat behind a large rock near the opening. "Why is he so mad at me?" Maya asked. "Well, you said you were having memories, Maya. What kind?" "I don't know. Of another time, I guess, trying to stop some other violence. That's why this is all so eerie to me." "Does Curtis seem familiar to you?" She struggled to think. "Maybe. I don't know." "Why? Do you remember when I told you earlier about seeing a vision of all of us in the past during the Native American Wars? Well, you were killed, and someone else was with you who seemed to be following your lead, and he was killed too. I think it was Curtis." "He blames me? Oh, God, no wonder he's so mad. Maya, can you remember anything about what you two were doing?" She closed her eyes again and tried to think. Suddenly, she looked at me. "Was a Native American also there? A shaman?" "Yes," I said. "He was killed, too." "We were thinking about something." She suddenly looked me in the eye. "No. No, we were visualizing. We thought we could stop the war." "That's all I can get. You've got to talk to Curtis and work through this anger. It's part of the process of remembering." "Are you kidding? With him this angry?" "I'll go speak to him first," I said, standing up. She nodded slightly and looked away. I moved to the cave's opening, crawled out, and sat down beside Curtis. "What do you think?" I asked. He looked at me, slightly embarrassed. "I think there's something about your friend that makes me mad." "Well, what are you feeling, exactly?" "I don't know. I felt angry as soon as I saw her out there. I got the sense she might pull some blunder and expose us, or get us captured."
"Maybe killed?"
"Yeah, maybe killed. Remember when I told you about the visions I saw of a time during the 19th century Native American Wars?"
"Vaguely," he muttered.
"Well, I didn't tell you then, but I think I saw you and Maya together. Curtis, you were both killed by soldiers." He looked at the ceiling of the cave.
"And you think that's why I'm angry at her?"
I smiled. At that moment, a light dissonance filled the air, and we both heard the hum.
"Damn," he said. "They're firing it up again."
I grabbed his arm. "Curtis, we've got to figure out what you and Meyer were trying to do back then, why you failed, and what you intended to happen differently this time." He shook his head.
"I don't know how much of all of this I even believe. I wouldn't know where to begin."
"I think if you just talk to her, something will come up." He just looked at me. "Will you try?" Finally, he nodded, and we crawled back into the cave. Maya smiled awkwardly.
"I'm sorry I've been so angry," Curtis offered. "Seems maybe I'm mad about something that occurred a long time ago."
"Forget it," she said.
"I just wish we could remember what we were trying to do."
Curtis looked hard at Maya.
"I seem to remember you're into healing of some kind."
He glanced at me.
"Did you tell me that?"
"I don't think so," I replied, "but it's true."
"I'm a physician," Maya said. "I use positive imaging and faith in my work."
"Faith? You mean you treat people from a religious perspective?"
"Well, only in a general sense. When I said faith, I meant the energy force that comes from human expectation. I work at a clinic where we're trying to understand faith as an actual mental process, as the way we help create the future."
"And how long have you been into all this?" Curtis asked. Maya didn't answer. She stood up and stared straight ahead, a panicked look on her face.
"What's wrong?" I asked. "I was just... I see what happened during the wars."
"What was it?" Curtis asked. She looked at him. "I remember we were there in the woods.
I can see it all. The soldiers. Smoke from the gunpowder."
Curtis seemed to be pulled into deep thought, obviously picking up on the memory.
"I was there," he mumbled.
"Why was I there?" He looked at Maya.
"You brought me to that place. I knew nothing. I was just a congressional observer. You told me we could stop the fighting.
I'm sorry, she said. I can't remember what went wrong.
I know what went wrong, he said. You thought you could stop a war just because you wanted to.
She gazed at him for a long moment, then looked at me.
He's right.
We were visualizing that the soldiers must stop their aggression, but we had no clear picture of how that could happen. It didn't work because we didn't have all the information. Everyone was visualizing from fear, not faith. It works just like the process of healing in our bodies. When we remember what we're really supposed to do in life, it can restore our health. When we're able to remember what all humanity is supposed to do, starting right now, from this moment, we can heal the world. Apparently, I continued, our birth vision contains not only what we individually intended to do in the physical dimension, but also a larger vision of what humans have been trying to do throughout history, and the details of where we are going from here and how to get there. We just have to amplify our energy and share our birth intentions, and then we can remember. Before she could respond, Curtis jumped to his feet and moved to the cave's opening.
I heard something, he said. Someone's out there.
Maya and I crouched beside him, straining to see. Nothing moved. Then I thought I detected the rustling sound of someone walking.
I'm going to check this out, Curtis said, moving through the opening.
I glanced at Maya. I'd better go with him.
I'm coming too, she said.
We followed Curtis down the slope to an outcropping where we could look straight down at the gorge between the two hills. A man and a woman, partially obscured by the underbrush, were crossing the rocks below us, heading toward the west.
That woman's in trouble, Maya said.
How do you know that? I asked.
I just know. She looks familiar.
The woman turned once, and the man pushed her, menacingly, exposing a pistol held in his right hand. The woman had light hair and was dressed in green fatigues with leg pockets and a sweatshirt.
That's Charlene, I said. Where do you think they're taking her?
Who knows? Curtis replied.
Look, I think I can help her, but I have to go alone. I need both of you to stay here.
I protested, but Curtis would have it no other way. We watched him as he walked back to the left and down the slope through a section of woods. From there, he crept quietly to another outcropping of rock just 10 feet above the bottom of the gorge. They'll have to pass right by him, I told Maya. We observed anxiously as they moved closer to the rocks. At the precise moment they had passed, Curtis suddenly bounded down the hill and leaped upon the man, knocking him to the ground and holding his throat in a peculiar fashion until he stopped moving. Charlene jumped back in alarm and gathered herself to run.
Charlene, wait! Curtis called.
She stopped and took a cautious step forward.
It's Curtis Farrell. We worked together at Dell Tech, remember?
I'm here to help you.
She obviously recognized him and moved closer. Maya and I made our way carefully down the hill. When Charlene saw me, she froze, and then ran toward my embrace. Curtis rushed up and pushed us to the ground.
Keep down, he said. We could be seen here.
I helped Curtis tie up Charlene's guard with a roll of tape we found in his pocket, and pulled him up the slope into the forest.
What did you do to him? Charlene asked.
Curtis was checking his pockets. I just knocked him out. He'll be okay. Maya bent down to check his pulse. Charlene turned her attention to me, reaching out for my hand.
How did you get here? She asked.
Taking a breath, I told her about the call from her office informing me of her disappearance, and about finding the sketch and coming to the valley to look for her. She smiled. I made that sketch intending to call you, but I left so suddenly I didn't have time. Her voice trailed off as she looked deeply into my eyes. Finally, she said,
I think I saw you yesterday. In the other dimension.
I pulled her to the side, away from the others. I saw you too, but I couldn't communicate. As we stared at each other, I felt my body grow lighter, a wave of orgasmic love sweeping across me, centered not in my pelvic region, but somehow around the outside of my skin. Simultaneously, I seemed to be falling into Charlene's eyes. Her smile grew, and I realized she must be feeling much the same way. A movement from Curtis broke the spell, and I realized both he and Maya were staring at us.
I looked back at Charlene. I want to tell you what's been happening, I said. Then described seeing Will again, learning about the polarization of fear, and the group coming back. Charlene, how did you get into the afterlife dimension? Her face fell. Oh, this is my fault. I didn't know the danger until yesterday. While you were still in Peru, I found out about another group that knew of the 9 insights and studied with them intensely. I had many of the same experiences you talked about in the letter you wrote. Later, I came with a friend to this valley because we had heard that the sacred locations here were connected somehow to the 10th insight. My friend didn't experience much, but I did, so I stayed to explore. That's when I met Feynman, who employed me to teach him what I knew. With Feynman, I explored most of the vortexes, especially the ones at Cotter's Knoll and the falls. He couldn't sense the energy personally, but I found out later that he was tracking us electronically and getting some sort of energy profile on me as we tuned into the spot. After that, he could home in on the area and find the exact location of the vortex electronically. I glanced at Curtis, and he nodded knowingly. Tears filled Charlene's eyes. He had me completely fooled. He said that he was working on a very inexpensive source of energy that will liberate everyone. He sent me to remote areas of the forest during much of the experimentation. Only later, after I confronted him, did he admit the dangers of what he was doing. Curtis turned to face Charlene. Feynman Carter was the chief engineer at Dell Tech. Do you remember? No, she said. But he's totally in control of this project. Another corporation is now involved, and they have these armed men. Feynman calls them operatives. I finally told him I was leaving, and that's when he put me under guard. When I told him he would never get away with this, he just laughed. He bragged about having someone in the interior department working with him. Where was he sending you? Curtis asked. Charlene shook her head. I have no idea. I don't think he intended to let you live, Curtis said. Not after telling you all that. I became aware that Charlene was staring at Maya and smiling. Maya returned the gaze with a warm expression. When I was at the falls, Charlene said, I moved through and into the other dimension, and all these memories rushed in. She looked at me. After that, I was able to go back several times, even when I was under guard yesterday. She looked at me. That's where I saw you. Charlene paused and looked back at the group. I saw that we're all here to stop this experiment, if we can remember everything. Maya was watching her closely. You understood what we wanted to do during the battle with the soldiers, and supported us, even though you knew it couldn't work. Charlene's smile told me she had remembered. We've remembered most of what happened, I said. But so far we haven't been able to recall how we plan to do it differently this time. Can you remember? Charlene shook her head. Only parts of it. I know we have to identify our unconscious feelings toward one another before we can go on. She looked into my eyes and paused. This is all part of the 10th insight, only it hasn't been written down anywhere yet. It's coming in intuitively. I nodded. We know. Part of the 10th is an extension of the 8th. Only a group that's operating fully in the 8th insight can accomplish this kind of higher clearing. I'm not following you, Curtis said. The 8th is about knowing how to uplift others, she continued. Knowing how to send energy by focusing on another's beauty and higher self-wisdom. This process can raise the energy level and creativity of the group exponentially. Unfortunately, many groups have trouble uplifting each other in this manner, even though the individuals involved are able to do it at other times. This is especially true if the group is work-oriented, a group of employees, for instance, or people coming together to create a unique project of some kind, because so often these people have been together before. The problem is that old past-life emotions come up and get in the way. We are thrown together with someone we have to work with, and we automatically dislike them without really knowing why. Or perhaps we experience it the other way around. The person doesn't like us, again for reasons we don't understand. The emotions that come up might be jealousy, irritation, envy, resentment, bitterness, blame, any of these. What I intuited very clearly was that no group could reach its highest potential unless the participants seek to understand and work through these emotions. Maya leaned forward. That's exactly what we've been doing, working through the emotions that have come up, the resentments from when we were together before. Were you shown your birth vision? I asked. Yes, Charlene replied, but I couldn't get any further. I didn't have enough energy. All I saw was that groups were forming and that I was supposed to be here in this valley, in a group of seven. Where were the others? Presently the sound of another vehicle, far to the north, attracted our attention. We can't stay here, Curtis said. We're too exposed. Let's get back to the cave. Charlene finished the last of the food and handed me the plate. Having no extra water, I placed it in my pack, dirty, and sat down again. Curtis slipped through the mouth of the cave and sat down across from me beside Maya, who smiled faintly at him. Charlene sat to my left. The operative had been left outside the cave, still bound and gagged. Is everything okay outside? Charlene asked Curtis. Curtis looked nervous. I think so. But I heard some more sounds to the north. I think we need to stay in here, the cave, until dark. For a moment we all just looked at each other, each of us obviously trying to raise our energy. Finally, I looked at the others and told them about the process of reaching the world vision I had seen with Feynman's soul group. When I had concluded, I looked at Charlene and asked, what else did you receive about this clearing process? All I got, Charlene replied, was that the process couldn't begin until we came totally back to love.
Well, that's easy to say, Curtis said. The problem is doing it.
We all looked at each other. Then simultaneously we realized the energy was moving to Maya. The key is to acknowledge the emotion, to become fully conscious of the feeling, and then to share it honestly, no matter how awkward our attempts. This brings the emotion fully into present awareness and ultimately allows it to be relegated to the past where it belongs. That's why going through the sometimes long process of saying it, discussing it, putting it on the table, clears us, so that we are able to return to a state of love, which is the highest emotion. For a moment, we all looked at each other, and I realized that most of the negative emotion had dissipated. Wait a minute, I said. What about Charlene? There may be residual emotions toward her. I looked at Maya. I know you felt something. Yes, Maya replied, but only positive feelings, a sense of gratitude. She stayed and tried to help. Maya paused, studying Charlene's face. You tried to tell us something about the ancestors, but we didn't listen. I leaned toward Charlene. Were you killed, too? Maya answered for her. No, she wasn't killed. She had gone to try to appeal to the soldiers one more time. That's right. But the troopers were gone. Maya asked, who else feels something towards Charlene?
I don't feel anything, Curtis said.
What about you, Charlene? I asked. What do you feel toward us? For a moment, her gaze swept across each member of the group. There doesn't seem to be any residual feeling toward Curtis, she said. And everything is positive toward Maya. Her eyes settled on mine. Toward you, I think I feel a bit of resentment.
Why?
I asked. Because you were so practical and detached. You were this independent man who wasn't about to get involved if the timing wasn't perfect. Charlene, I said, I'd already sacrificed myself for these insights as a monk. I felt it would have been useless. My protest seemed to irritate her, and she looked away. Maya reached over and touched me. Your comment was defensive. When you respond that way, the other person doesn't feel heard. The emotion she harbors then lingers in her mind because she continues to think of ways to make you understand, to convince you. Or it goes unconscious, and then there's ill feeling that dulls the energy between you two. Either way, the emotion remains a problem, getting in the way. I suggest you acknowledge how she could be feeling that. I looked at Charlene. Oh, I do. I wish that I had helped. Maybe I could have done something if I'd had the courage. Charlene nodded and smiled. How about you? Maya asked, looking at me. What do you feel toward Charlene? I guess I feel some guilt, I said. Not so much guilt about the war, but now, about this situation. I had been withdrawn for several months. I think if I had talked to you immediately after returning from Peru, maybe we could have stopped the experiment earlier, and none of this would be happening. No one replied. Are there any other feelings? Maya asked. We only looked at each other. At this point, under Maya's direction, each of us focused on connecting inside, with building as much energy as we could. As I focused on the beauty around me, a wave of love swept through my body. The muted color of the cave walls and floor began to brighten and glow. Each person's face began to appear more energized. A chill ran up my spine. Now, Maya said, we're ready to figure out what we intended to do this time. She again appeared to be in deep thought. I knew this was going to happen, she said finally. This was part of my birth vision. I was to lead the amplification process. We didn't know how to do this when we tried to stop the war on the Native Americans. As she spoke, I noticed a movement behind her against the cave wall. At first, I thought it was a reflection of light. But then I detected a deep shade of green, exactly like the one I witnessed earlier when observing Maya's soul group. As I struggled to focus on the foot-square blob of light, it swelled into a full holographic scene, receding into the wall itself, full of fuzzy, human-like forms. I glanced at the others. No one seemed to see the image except me. This, I knew, was Maya's soul group. Once free of the emotions, Maya was now saying, a group can more easily move past power struggles and dramas and find its full creativity. But we have to do it consciously by finding a higher self-expression in every face. I watched Maya, attempting to find her higher expression. No longer did she appear tired or reluctant in any way. Instead, her features revealed a certainty and genius she had not expressed before. I glanced toward the others and saw that they were similarly focused on Maya. When I looked at her again, I noticed she seemed to be taking on the green hue of her soul group. She was not only picking up on their knowledge, she seemed to be moving into a kind of harmony with them. Maya had stopped speaking and was taking a deep breath. I could feel the energy shifting away from her. I've always known that groups could acquire a higher level of functioning, Curtis suddenly said. Especially in work settings. But I haven't been able to experience this until now. I know I came into this dimension to be involved in transforming business and shifting our view of business creativity so that we can ultimately utilize the new energy sources in the correct way and implement the ninth insight automation of production. I felt as though business, too, was moving into a spiritual awareness and that we needed a new kind of business ethic. At that moment, I saw another movement of light directly behind Curtis. I watched for a few seconds, then I realized I was seeing the formation of his soul group as well. Only now, Curtis suddenly said, are we ready to understand how to evolve business and the resulting new technology in a conscious manner? All the measures are now in place. It's not an accident that one of the most important statistical categories in economics is the productivity index. The record of how many goods and services are produced by each individual in our society. Gains in productivity have steadily increased because of technological discoveries and the more expansive use of natural resources and energy. Through the years, the individual has found ever greater ways to create. As he spoke, a thought came to me. At first, I decided to keep it to myself, but then everyone looked my way. Doesn't the environmental damage that economic growth is causing form a natural limit to business? Many of the fish in the ocean are already so polluted we can't eat them. Cancer rates are increasing exponentially. Even the AMA says that pregnant women and children should not eat commercial vegetables because of the pesticide residue. If this keeps up, can you imagine what kind of world we'll be leaving our children? As soon as I had said this, I recalled what Joel had said earlier about the collapse of the environment. I could feel my energy falling, as I felt the same fear. Suddenly, I was hit with a burst of energy
as each of the others stared in an effort to find my authentic expression again. I quickly reestablished my inner connection.
You're right, Curtis said.
But our response to this problem is already shifting. We've been advancing technology with a kind of unconscious tunnel vision, forgetting that we're here on an organic planet, an energy planet. But one of the most creative areas of business is the field of pollution control. Our problem has been trying to depend on government to police the polluters. Polluting has been against the law for a long time, but there will never be enough government regulation to prevent the illegal dumping of waste chemicals or the midnight venting of smokestacks. This polluting of the biosphere won't completely stop until an alarmed citizenry pulls out their video recorders and takes it upon themselves to catch those people in the act. In a sense, business and the employees of business must regulate themselves. Maya leaned forward. I see another problem with the way the economy is evolving. What about all the displaced workers who are losing their jobs as more of the economy is automated? How can they survive? We used to have a large middle class, and now it is diminishing rapidly. Curtis smiled, and his eyes brightened. The image of his soul group swelled behind him. These displaced people were survived by learning to live intuitively and synchronistically, he said. We all have to understand. There's no going back. We're already living in the information age. Everyone will have to educate themselves the best they can, become an expert in some niche, so that they can be in the right place to advise someone else or perform some other service. The more technical automation becomes, and the more quickly the world changes, the more we need information from just the right person arriving in our lives at just the right time. You don't need a formal education to do that. Just a niche you've created for yourself through self-education. A new code of ethics is being added to the equation of free enterprise. We can move toward a truly enlightened capitalism if, instead of charging as much as the market will bear, we follow a new business ethic based on lowering our prices a specified percentage as a conscious statement of where we want the economy to go. This would be the business equivalent of engaging in the ninth insight force of tithing. Charlene turned to face him, her face luminous. I understand what you're saying. You mean if all businesses reduce prices 10%, then everyone's cost of living, including the raw material and supplies to the businesses themselves, will also go down.
That's right. Although some prices might go up temporarily as everyone takes into account the true cost of waste disposal and other environmental effects. Overall, though, prices will systematically decline.
Do you really think enough people will reduce prices to make a difference? Maya asked, especially if it takes money out of their own pockets. That seems to fly in the face of human nature. Curtis didn't answer. Instead, he looked at me, along with the others, as if I had the answer. For a moment, I was silent, feeling the energy shift. Curtis is right, I said finally. We'll do it anyway, even though we may give up some personal profit in the short run. None of this makes any sense at all until we grasp the ninth and tenth insights. If one grasps the first nine insights and sees life in spiritual terms as a spiritual evolution with spiritual responsibilities, then our view completely changes. And once we begin to understand the tenth, then we see the birth process from the perspective of the afterlife. And we realize that we're all here to bring the earth dimension into alignment with the heavenly sphere. Besides, opportunity and success is a very mysterious process. And if we operate our economic life in the flow of the overall plan, we synchronistically meet all the other people who are doing the same thing, and suddenly, prosperity opens up for us. We'll do it, I continued, because individually, that's where the intuition and coincidences will take us. We'll remember more about our birth visions, and it will become clear that we intended to make a certain contribution to the world. And most importantly, we'll know that if we don't follow this intuition, not only will the magic coincidences and the sense of inspiration and aliveness stop, but eventually we may have to look at our actions in an afterlife review. We'll have to face our failure. I stopped abruptly, noticing that Charlene and Maya were both staring wide-eyed at the space behind me. I turned around. behind me was the hazy outline of my own soldiers. Dozens of individuals fading into the distance. Again, as though the wall of a cave weren't there. What are all of you looking at? Curtis asked. The soldiers, Charlie inquired. I've seen a group behind both Maya and Curtis, I said. Maya twisted around and looked at the space behind her. The group there flickered once and then came fully into focus.
I don't see anything, Curtis said. Where are they?
Maya continued to stare, obviously seeing all of the groups.
They're helping us, aren't they?
Yes, Charlene replied, looking directly at me. She started to say something else, then stopped herself, appearing to drift off in thought momentarily. Finally, she said, I'm beginning to understand what I saw in the other dimension. In the afterlife, each of us comes from a particular soul group, and these groups each have a particular angle or truth to offer the rest of humanity. She glanced at me. For instance, you come from a group of facilitators. Do you know that? Souls that help evolve our philosophical understanding of what life is about. Everyone who belongs to this particular soul group is always trying to find the best and most comprehensive way of describing spiritual reality. You struggle with complex information, and because you're so dense, you keep pushing and exploring until you find a way to express it clearly. I looked at her askance, which made her burst out laughing. It's a gift you have, she said, reassuringly. Turning to Maya, she said, and you, Maya. Your soul group is oriented toward health and well-being. They think of themselves as soldiers of the physical dimension, keeping ourselves operating optimally and full of energy, tracing and removing emotional blocks before they manifest in disease. Curtis's group is about transforming the use of technology, as well as our overall understanding of commerce. Throughout human history, this group has been working to spiritualize our concepts of money and capitalism, to find the ideal conceptualization. She paused, and I could already see an image of light flickering behind her.
What about you, Charlene? I asked. What is your group doing?
We're journalists, researchers, she replied, working to help people appreciate and learn from each other. What journalism is really all about is looking deeply at the life and beliefs of the people and organizations we cover, at their true substance, the higher expression and form, such as we're seeing in each other now, their positive message and contribution to the world. I again remembered my conversation with Joel, specifically his jaded cynicism.
It's hard to see journalists doing that, I said.
We're not, she replied. Not yet. But this is the ideal toward which the profession is evolving. This is our true destiny, once we become more secure and break free from the old worldview in which we need to win and bring energy and status our way. It makes perfect sense why I wanted to be born into my family. They were all so inquisitive. I picked up on their excitement, their need for information. That's why I was a reporter for so long, and then with a research firm. I wanted to help work out the ethics of reporting, and then come together with all of... She paused and drifted away again, staring at the floor of the cave. Then her eyes widened, and she said, I know how we're bringing in the world vision. As we remember our birth visions and integrate them together as a group, we merge the power of our relative groups in the other dimension. That helps us remember even more, so we finally get to the overall vision of the world. We all stared at her, puzzled. Look at the whole picture, she explained. Each person on Earth belongs to a soul group, and these soul groups represent the various occupational groups that exist on the planet. Medical people, lawyers, accountants, computer workers, farmers, every field of human endeavor. Once people find their right work, the job that really fits them, then they are working with other members of their soul group. As each of us wakes up and begins to remember our birth visions,
The occupational groups to which we belong come more into enlightenment with the members of our group in the other dimension. And each occupational group on Earth moves toward its true soul purpose, its role of service in human society. We all continue to be spellbound. It's like with us journalists, she continued. Throughout history, we have been the individuals most inquisitive about what others in the culture are doing. And then, a few centuries ago, we became conscious enough of ourselves to form a defined occupation. Since then, we've been busy broadening our use of the media and reaching more and more people with our newscasts, that sort of thing. But, like everyone else, we suffered from insecurity. We felt that to get attention and energy from the rest of humanity, we had to create increasingly more sensational stories, thinking that only negativity and violence sells. But that's not our true role. Our spiritual role is to deepen and spiritualize our perception of other people. We see and then communicate what the various soul groups and individuals within these groups are doing and what they stand for, making it easier for everyone to learn the truth others provide. It's the same for every occupational group. We're all awakening to our true message and purpose. And as this happens all over the planet, we're then able to go further. We can form close spiritual associations with people outside our particular soul group, just the way we're doing here, now. See what just happened? We all shared the message we came here to offer, the message that was foreshown in our birth visions. And that transforms not only human society, but the culture in the afterlife as well. First, each of our soul groups comes closer into vibration with us on Earth, and we with them. The two dimensions opening into each other. Because of this closure, we can begin to have communication between the dimensions. We are able to see souls in the afterlife and pick up on their knowledge and memory more readily. That's happening with increasing frequency on the Earth. As Charlene was speaking, I noticed the soul groups behind each of us widening and spreading out, until each touched the others, forming a continuous circle around us. The convergence seemed to jolt me into an even higher awareness. Charlene seemed to feel it too. She took a breath, and then with emphasis, continued. The other thing that happens in the afterlife is that the groups themselves come closer into resonance with each other. That's why the Earth is the primary focus of the souls in heaven. They can't unite on their own. Over there, soul groups remain fragmented and out of resonance with each other because they live in an imaginary world of ideas that manifest instantly and disappear just as quickly. So, reality is always arbitrary. There is no natural world, no atomic structure as we have here that serves as a stable platform, a background stage, that is common to all of us. We affect what happens on this stage, but ideas manifest much more slowly, and we must reach some agreement on what we want to happen in the future. It's this agreement, this consensus, this unity of vision on the Earth that also pulls the soul groups together in the afterlife dimension. That's why the Earth dimension is deemed so important. The physical arena is the theater upon which evolution has been playing out for both dimensions. And now, we're bringing it all into culmination as we remember consciously what's going on. She pointed to each of us with a sweeping motion of her finger. This is the awareness that we're remembering together, right now. And it's the awareness that other groups, just like us, are remembering all over the planet. We all have a piece of the complete vision. And when we share what we know and unify our soul groups, then we're ready to bring the whole picture into consciousness. Suddenly, Charlene was interrupted by a slight tremor that ran through the earth under the cave. Specks of dust fell from the ceiling. Simultaneously, we heard the hum again, but this time, the dissonance had disappeared. It sounded almost harmonious.
Oh, God, Curtis said. They almost had the calibrations right. We have to go back to the bunker.
He made a movement to get up as the energy level of the group plummeted. Wait, I said. What are we going to do there? We agreed that we would wait here until dark. There's still hours of daylight out there. I say we stay here. We achieved a high level of energy, but we haven't moved through the rest of the process yet. We seem to have cleared our residual emotions and amplified our energy and shared our birth visions, but we haven't seen the intention behind history yet. I think we can do more if we remain where it's safe and try to go farther.
It's too late for that, Curtis said. They're ready to complete the experiment. If anything can be done, we've got to go there and do it now.
I looked hard at him. You said they were probably going to kill Charlene. If we're caught, they'll do the same to us.
Maya held her head in her hands, and Curtis looked away, trying to shake off the panic.
Well, I'm going, Curtis finally said.
Charlene leaned forward. I think we should stay together.
For an instant, I saw her in Native American clothing, again in the virgin woods of the 19th century. The image quickly faded. Maya stood up.
Charlene is right, she said. We have to stay together, and it might help if we can see what they're doing.
I looked out through the cave's entrance, a long, deep-seated reluctance rising in my gut. What are we going to do with this operative outside?
We'll drag him into the cave and leave him here, Curtis said. We can send someone for him in the morning, if we can.
I met eyes with Charlene, then nodded in agreement. We knelt at the top of the hill and looked carefully down at the base of a larger ridge. I could see nothing out of the ordinary in the fading light, no movement, no guards. The hum, which had persisted for most of the 40-minute walk, had now completely disappeared. Are you sure we're at the right place? I asked Curtis.
Yes, he said. You see the four large boulders about 50 feet up the slope? The doorway is right beneath them, hidden in the bushes. To the right, you can just make out the top of the projection dish. It looks functional again.
I see it, Maya said.
We waited for signs of activity, hesitant to move or talk much until darkness had fallen across the valley.
Suddenly, we heard a movement behind us. Flashlights clicked on, flooding us in light, and four armed men rushed in, demanding that we raise our hands and surrender.
After spending 10 minutes going through our gear, they thoroughly searched each of us, then moved the group down the hill and up to the bunker's entrance. The door of the bunker swung open, and Feynman charged out.
Are these the ones we've been looking for? He shouted. Where did you find them?
One of the guards explained what had happened, as Feynman shook his head.
What are you doing here? You've got to stop what you're doing, Curtis retorted. Curtis Farrell, I'll be damned, Feynman said. You blew up our dish, didn't you?
Listen to me, Curtis said. You know this generator's too dangerous to operate at these levels. You could ruin this entire valley.
You were always an alarmist, Farrell. That's why we let you go at Del Tech. I've been working on this project for too long to give up at this point. It's going to work exactly as I planned.
Curtis edged toward him.
You want to centralize the generating process so you can control it. That's not right.
Feynman stared angrily at Curtis.
You're so naive. Do you think the interests that act to control energy prices now would allow a sudden massive shift to an inexpensive source? Of course not. It has to be centralized and packaged to work at all. And I'm going to be known for having done this. It's what I was born to do.
That's not true, I blurted. You were born to do something else, to help us.
Feynman swung around to face me.
Shut up. Do you hear me? All of you!
He looked us over, then shook his head and walked over to one of the armed men.
Keep them here until this is over. All we need is another hour. If they try to escape, shoot them.
The operative spoke briefly to the other three, and they formed a perimeter, encircling us at a distance of about 30 feet.
Sit down,
one of them said in a foreign accent. We sat facing each other in the darkness, our energy almost totally deflated. There had been no signs of the soul groups since we left the cave.
What do you think we should do?
I asked Charlene.
Nothing's changed, she whispered. We've got to build our energy again.
The darkness was almost total, broken only by the operative's lights sweeping back and forth across the group. I could barely make out the outlines of the others' faces,
even though we were sitting in a tight circle, 8 feet apart.
We have to try to escape,
Curtis whispered.
I think they will kill us.
Suddenly I remembered the image I'd seen in Feynman's birth vision. He envisioned being with us in the woods, in the dark. I knew there was also another landmark in the scene, but I couldn't remember what it was.
No,
I said. I think we need to try again, here. At that moment, the air was filled with a high-pitched sound, a sound similar to the hum, but again, more in harmony, almost pleasing to the ear. Again, a perceptible shimmer swept through the ground under our bodies.
We have to increase our energy now,
Maya whispered. I don't know if I can do it here, Curtis responded.
You have to,
I said.
Focus on each other the way we did before,
Maya added. I tried to screen out the ominous scene around us and return to an inner state of love. Ignoring the shadows and the flickering beams of light, I focused on the beauty of the faces in the circle. As I struggled to locate the other's higher self-expression, I began to notice a shift in the light pattern around us. Gradually, I could see every face and expression very clearly, as though I was looking through an infrared viewer.
What do we visualize?
Curtis asked in desperation.
We have to get back to our birth visions, Maya said. Remember why we came.
Suddenly, the ground shook violently, and the sound from the experiment again took on a dissonant, grating quality.
We've got to visualize stopping them, Curtis said.
We moved closer together, and our collective thoughts seemed to project the image of fighting back. We knew that somehow we could marshal our forces and push back the negative and destructive attempts of the experiment. I even picked up a picture of Feynman being pushed backward, his equipment blowing up and burning, his men fleeing in terror. Another surge in the noise disrupted my focus. The experiment was continuing. 50 feet away, a huge pine tree snapped in half and thundered to the ground. With a ripping sound and a cloud of dust, a fissure 5 feet wide opened up between us and the guard on the right. He reeled back in horror, the beam of his flashlight swinging wild in the night.
This isn't working, Maya screamed.
Another tree crashed to the earth on our left, as the earth slid 4 or 5 feet, knocking us flat to the ground. Maya looked horrified and jumped to her feet.
I've got to get away from here,
she yelled, then began to run north into the darkness. The guard on that side, lying flat where he had been thrown by the earth's movement, rolled to his knees and caught her form in the beam of his flashlight, then raised his gun.
No! Wait!
I screamed. As she ran, Maya looked back, spotting the guard who was now aiming directly at her, preparing to fire at point-blank range. The scene seemed to shift into slow motion, and as the gun discharged, every line in her face revealed an awareness that she was about to die. But instead of the bullets ripping into her side and back, a wisp of white light darted in front of her, and the bullets bore no effect. She hesitated momentarily, then disappeared into the darkness. At the same time, sensing the opportunity, Charlene leaped up from her position to my right and ran to the northeast into the dust, her movement totally unnoticed by the guards. I started to run, but the guard who had fired at Maya turned his weapon toward me. Quickly, Curtis reached out and grabbed my legs, dragging me to the ground. Gradually, the noise began to diminish, and the earth's movement slowed to mere tremors.
For God's sake, Curtis yelled toward him, you've got to stop this now.
Feynman's face was covered with dust.
There's nothing wrong that we can't fix, he said, with eerie calm.
The guards were on their feet, dusting themselves off and walking toward us. Feynman noticed that Maya and Charlene were missing, but before he could say anything, the noise returned with ear-shattering volume, and the earth under us seemed to leap upward several feet, rolling everyone to the ground once more. The splintering limbs from a falling tree sent the guards scurrying toward the bunker.
Now, Curtis said, let's go!
We ran northeast in the same direction that Maya had fled. Several more tremors reverberated under our feet, and then the movements and sounds ceased. After making our way through the dark woods for several miles, our path lighted only by the rays of the moon filtering through the foliage, we stopped and huddled in a grove of small pines. A clear picture of the falls entered my mind. It was still pristine, undisturbed. We have to go northwest, to the falls, I said. Curtis nodded toward the north, and as silently as possible we headed in that direction, crossing the stream and carefully making our way toward the canyon. After another mile, we began to see the moonlit canyon walls rising up into the distance. As we approached the rocky mouth, Curtis led the way across the creek. Suddenly, he jumped backward in fright as another person walked around a tree from the left. The person screamed and recoiled, almost losing balance, teetering at the edge of a creek bank. Curtis recovered and lunged forward and pulled her back as rocks and gravel slid into the water. Leaning back against a larger tree, Maya took a deep breath, then asked, "What happened when that guard fired back there? How did those bullets miss me? I saw this strange streak of light." "I don't know," I said. We looked at each other. No one spoke. Then in the silence, I heard the distinct sound of someone walking up ahead. "Wait," I said to the others. "Someone's up there." We crouched down and waited. 10 minutes went by. Suddenly, from the trees ahead, Charlene walked up and dropped to her knees. "Thank God I found you," she said. Maya motioned for us, and we all moved out to a clearing where the creek went through the mouth of the canyon. Here, the full light of the moon illuminated the grass and the rocks to each side. "Maybe we're going to have another chance," she said, urging us with her hands to sit down and face each other. "What are we going to do?" Curtis said. "We can't stay here long. They'll be coming." I looked at Maya, thinking we should go on to the falls, but she seemed so energized that instead I asked, "What do you think went wrong before?" "I don't know. Maybe there were too few of us. You said there were supposed to be 7. Or perhaps there's too much fear." Charlene leaned toward the group. "I think we have to remember the energy we achieved when we were in the cave. We have to connect at that level again. We have to give each other energy. Find the higher self expression." I took several deep breaths and watched the faces of the others again. Gradually they became more beautiful and luminescent, and I caught sight of their authentic soul expression. Around us, the surrounding plants and rocks lit up even more, as though the moon's rays had suddenly doubled. A familiar wave of love and euphoria swept through my body, and I turned to see the shimmering figures of my soul group behind me. "Look at that," Charlene suddenly said, pointing at the soul groups all around us. Each soul group was beginning to blend with the others, just as they had done at the cave. I glanced at Charlene and then at Curtis and Maya. I could now see on their faces an even fuller expression of who they were as participants in the long movement of human civilization. "This is it," I said. "We're reaching the next step. We're seeing a more complete vision of human history." Suddenly, before us, in a huge hologram, appeared an image of history that seemed to stretch out from the very beginning to what appeared to be a distant end. As I strained to focus, I realized that this was an image very similar to the one I had observed earlier, while with my soul group, except that in this instance, the story was beginning much earlier, with the birth of the universe itself. Suddenly, we found ourselves watching as the first matter exploded into being and gravitated into stars that lived and died and spewed forth the great diversity of elements that ultimately formed the Earth. These elements, in turn, combined in the early terrestrial environment into ever more complex substances until they finally leaped into organic life. Life, which then also moved forward into greater organization and awareness, as if guided by an overall plan. A clear picture of the afterlife dimension opened up in front of us, and I understood instantly that an aspect of each of the souls there, in fact, a part of all humanity, had lived through this long, slow process of evolution. We had swam as fishes, boldly crawled upon the land as amphibians, and struggled to survive as reptiles, birds, and mammals, fighting every step of the way to finally move into human form, all with intention. We knew that through wave after wave of successive generations, we would be born into the physical plane, and no matter how long it took, we would strive to wake up and unify and evolve and eventually implement on Earth the same spiritual culture that exists in the afterlife. Certainly the journey would be difficult, even torturous. With the first intuition to awaken, we would sense the fear of aloneness and separateness. Yet, we would not go back to sleep. We would fight through the fear, relying on the dim intuition that we weren't alone, that we were spiritual beings with a spiritual purpose on the planet. And, following the urge of evolution, we would gravitate together into larger, more complex social groupings, differentiating into more diverse occupations, overcoming a need to defeat and conquer each other, and eventually implementing a democratic process through which new ideas could be shared and synthesized and evolved into even better truths. Gradually, our security would come from inside us. As we progressed from an expression of the divine in terms of nature gods to the divine as one Father God outside ourselves, to a final expression as the Holy Spirit within us.